The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the meeting to order, and I would like to start with introductions. I'll start with Mr. Ramey.
Good morning. My name is Gary Ramey, and I'm the member for Lunenburg West.
Matt Wynot, member for Hammonds Plains, Upper Sackville.
Brian Skibar, member for Cumberland North.
Good morning. Clary McKinnon, MLA, Pictou East.
Good morning. Alan McMaster, MLA for Inverness.
Beaumontant, Chris Thompson, Deputy d'Argyle.
Ann McDonald, Assistant Auditor General.
Darlene Henry, Committee Clerk.
Margaret McDonald, Deputy Minister of Finance.
Byron Rafuse, Associate Deputy Minister of Finance and Controller.
Good morning, everyone, and look forward to an interesting meeting. Mr. D'Antoine.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering, maybe for a couple of extra meetings, we of course had some news that the government spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in an untendered contract, and many Nova Scotians are concerned about that, the way that the taxpayers' dollars are being spent. I'm proposing today at the earliest convenience, or maybe at an emergency meeting of a public accounts at the committee, called Paul Black, the Director of Policy Community Relations, to explain the Premier's office role in decision to circumvent the tendering tendering process when it comes to ships start here.
Okay. What I would suggest you do, you prepare a letter for subcommittee, provide it to our subcommittee, and we'll take that under advisement at our subcommittee next week. Mr. D'Antoine?
Thank you very much, and I'm wondering, since this seems to be an extremely important issue, is there any way that we can consider that here and maybe have a further discussion about it, either at the beginning of this meeting or later on, because I think it would be an issue that would be considered sooner than later when it comes to this untendered contract.
Yes, we could do that. I would suggest possibly we do it immediately at the end of this meeting.
Sure.
I'll leave. How much time do you think it'll take?
It depends. I know where my position is on this one, so we'll have to see what the others think about bringing in Paul Black.
Okay, we will do that, and I'll leave some extra time, probably an extra 15 minutes at the end of the meeting to discuss it.
Thank you very much.
Great, thank you. Okay, we'd like to start the meeting today with Ms. McDonald. If you'd like to make a presentation, we'd be only too pleased to hear it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just have some opening comments. So as I say, my name is Margaret McDonald, Deputy Minister for the Department of Finance. I've been with the department since November of 2010, and I've appeared before public accounts before, but actually this is my first time in the role as Deputy Minister of Finance. And certainly thank you for the opportunity to come to the committee and to speak to the Auditor General's report, and we certainly hope that it'll be useful for you. As I've indicated, Byron Rafuse, the Associate Deputy Minister for the Department and the Controller, is with me, and I think you all know Byron, so I will refrain from more introductions on him. So we certainly recognize and appreciate the opportunity to come here to talk about the January 2012 Auditor General's report. We certainly realize and appreciate the importance of the work of the Auditor General's office, and we're certainly happy to respond in any way we can to your questions. We work closely in an ongoing way with the Auditor General's office throughout the year in many aspects of the work that we do with the Department of Finance. The big areas, of course, which you'd see in this report are the review of the revenues prior to the budget. And
excuse me, just one second. We have to make adjustment to your mic.
Sorry. Okay. Apologies. And we also work with the Auditor General's office extensively in releasing the year-end public accounts. And again, that's a matter of the current report of the Auditor General. I'd just like to mention we are the host department for the Internal Audit Center at the Department of Finance, which is a service provided to all of government. So it's just a way of saying that we certainly recognize the value of the auditing community and the work that we do. In the report itself, as many of you would know, I'd like to emphasize there were many positive comments. There are certainly areas for improvement, and we recognize that as well. And again, happy to comment on those when we have an opportunity. We do recognize that we haven't implemented all of the recommendations of the Auditor General. We certainly are willing to continue to work with the Auditor General, and I think we've sort of opened a few doors in some of the conversations that we've been having so that we can always improve the budget and the reporting process that were there. I just want to touch quickly then on the various chapters in the report. I'll try and do that quickly and then bring my comments to an end. So Chapter 2 looks at the results of financial audits and reviews. It provides summary comments and recommendations on government financial reporting with respect to our budget cycle, including revenue estimates, consolidated financial statements, and budget forecast updates. The reporting of revenues from government units and the forecasting of petroleum revenues have been raised as issues in this particular chapter. The audit opinion on the review of our revenue estimates in April of 2011 was qualified because the estimates did not consider all revenues in the consolidated entity. And our response at the end of the chapter indicates that the inclusion of those revenues and the associated offsetting expenses in the annual budget would require changes to our budget process, and we'd be pleased to speak to that. I guess I would say that this has been a matter that's been outstanding for, I think, since we moved to a consolidated approach to the financial statements. It's an accounting matter, and we certainly will continue to work with the Auditor General's office to see if we can find a resolution on this matter. We think it's important that we do have good transparency. We do provide a lot of information to Nova Scotians, particularly through the public accounts. And I would just note for your reference that we have received an unqualified opinion with respect to the public accounts for that year. Anyway, we can speak more about that if you have any questions. With regard to the petroleum royalties, we do feel that there is a rigorous process to ensure royalties are forecasted appropriately. We do involve the Department of Energy in that particular piece of work. Certain inputs into that royalty model include proprietary information, which is the reason why we have difficulty in bringing in a third party or an independent review of those of the royalty review. So that accounts for why we have difficulty in implementing the recommendation that the Auditor General has made in that area. There are also recommendations in this chapter to improve model-based revenue projections. That's a fairly complex area, but we are working to implement most of the recommendations, and we will continue to work to improve the revenue model projection process. Chapter 3 reviews the financial governance and control framework for our debt management practices. And I would like to note that the Auditor General was quite positive about this area of the department. He did confirm that there was adequate oversight and risk management policies. And this is the area of the department that is responsible for the oversight of the current debt that we have and managing the activities in the capital markets with respect to that debt. I'd like to also point out we've implemented all of the recommendations that were made in that report.
And just as I said, for clarity, that particular division manages the activities around the current public debt and takes into account and manages in that process interest rate risks, credit risk, liquidity risk, and foreign currency risk to ensure that the provincial debt is managed appropriately. We have policies in place to identify and control those risks, and as the report indicated, our Debt Management Committee provides adequate oversight of this work. So I'm actually very proud of the work of the Department in this area, and I'm happy to see that Chapter 3 really reflects the excellent work the Department of Finance has done in this area over the past number of years to ensure that we have an appropriate operating unit there. Chapter 4 is a chapter which was written by the Auditor General with respect to financial indicators on the debt. The Department of Finance did not participate in the preparation of this report, so because of that, I would simply note that it's there, and I don't have any particular comments with respect to the Auditor General's report in that area. Chapter 5 is review and audit reports and management letters for other departments and organizations. And I just would point out that the Department of Finance doesn't get access to the management letters until we have access to it in the Auditor General's report. So some of these issues would not necessarily have been known to the Department of Finance through our work. So I guess what I would say is that if you have questions and concerns there, we would likely probably have to refer you to the department, or we would certainly seek to get the information for you from the department, but our activities in some of those areas are somewhat limited. And the final chapter of the report, Chapter 6, is an indication of our success in implementing the recommendations made by the Auditor General. Almost all of the recommendations are the responsibility of the Department of Finance. There are a couple there that relate to other departments. And so we have accepted and implemented about 76% of those recommendations. I won't go into detail about some of the ones that we haven't implemented because that may be part of the discussion this morning. But I guess I would like to point out that we do have a significant record of implementing the recommendations, and we certainly want to continue to work and to try and do that. So we value the Auditor General's comments in those regard, and we do work to try and implement as best we can. So that's a very quick and general overview of the report and how it actually relates to the work of the Department of Finance. Mr. Rayfuse and I would be certainly happy to answer any of your questions. And if there's anything that you ask us today that we're unable to provide, then we'd certainly be happy to bring those questions back to our colleagues and provide whatever information the committee requires.
Thank you very much. First round of questioning for 20 minutes. I would recognize Mr. Younger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for being a few minutes late. Keep underestimating the delay caused by the waterside construction down there now that they've knocked it down to one lane. I want to get into some questions here about some of the sections, but I first just, I did want to comment, and this comes out of the start of the review of this report a few weeks ago when the Auditor General was berated by the member for Halifax Chibucto, and I think we all remember that. And I just want to, I'm not going to, unlike the other member, I'm not going to spend all my time doing that, but I think he was wrong. Mr. Chair, you ask that we bring a few trees with us to table everything, so I have done that. First of all, I will table the comments of the member as reported to the media. I think we're all well aware of them, so I won't go through them. I will then table the comments of the Minister of Finance, who actually defended, and I'm glad he did, the Auditor General in saying what he said. He called it an essay. He said he didn't agree, but I think that's fine. You know, the Finance Minister has every right to agree or not agree in Department of Finance with various recommendations. I'm also going to draw the members of the committee's attention to the Auditor General's Act, which specifically allows the Auditor General to write what he did, and I will table that. Under the definition, I didn't table the whole act, just table the definition in question, Mr. Chair, because I think we can all get the whole act and try to save a few trees anyways. It allows for investigations, and the Act defines investigation as, quote, meaning any examination that results in observations but does not lead to opinion. And I think that's exactly what that was. It was an observation, and it's very much in line with observations that have been made in recent years by Auditor Generals in New Brunswick and also also federally, on debt and the risk of debt. And frankly, I think that probably debt management, and that is probably one of the biggest things we have, one of the biggest risks we have going forward. And so I want to thank the Auditor General for including that chapter, because I think my personal bias is I agree with what he said, but the even if I didn't agree, I think it's important to have those opinions from people who are officers of the legislature. We have not a whole lot of people who are officers of the legislature, but there are a few positions that are, and I think that those opinions are extremely important for the legislature to be able to consider on a go-forward basis. So with that, I do. I felt it was important to address that issue since it was very important, Mr. Chair, but I don't want to spend all my time on that. As the former member did. Instead, I want to move forward to asking, and I'll start with section chapter 2. And you can almost guess that this is where I was going to go, is this whole issue of reporting of third-party entities. This has come up repeatedly since 2001. And here is, long before I was here, this is troublesome to me, and I think it's obviously troublesome to the Auditor General, since this is why that section repeatedly gets an unqualified statement. And it's more troubling to me because the government, the current government, has made significant noise about the fact they were trying, they had this Deloitte report done in 2009 when they came to power, and how we're following this recommendation, we're following this recommendation. And the Deloitte report is always held up as the Deloitte report is always held up by the current government as this is why we're doing this. But of course, when it said don't carry forward education funding, even when the Deloitte report said that, it's like, oh yeah, yeah, but we're going to ignore that section. And I'd like to table another section of the Deloitte report. I think there are two pages. Oh, it's a single page, so I'll table this, where the Deloitte actually makes the exact same recommendations, and this will work its way around shortly, but in fact, in 4.5, you'll see on this paper, recommendation 1A, Deloitte, in their recommendation to government, made the exact same recommendation that the Auditor General is making again, which is move to a schedule of all revenues, consolidated fund, and government units to be prepared for inclusion in budget documents and examination by the Auditor General. So now we have not only the Auditor General saying that, but the independent auditing firm that the government of today decided to contract, saying this is exactly what the government should do, and the government is still saying no. So when will those, when will all those revenues be consolidated?
Thank you for the question. I became aware of this issue recently in the department. As I said in my opening statements, I've been Deputy Minister at Department of Finance now for about a year and a half or something under that, and understood that this issue has been going on, as you said, for quite a long time. So what I've asked the staff to do, I can't sort of say to you today that it will be resolved, but I've opened up some doors to some conversations to see if we can actually find a resolution to this particular issue, because it's been going on for a long time. I'd like Mr. Rayfus perhaps to give you a bit more of a technical description about some of the issues we have associated with that. I think that I would say that I think the general understanding around the development of the budget when the government moved to adopt generally accepted accounting principles was to really reflect in the budget the expenditures and the activities, the revenues and expenditures associated with the general revenue fund, which is what you will find that the budget does deal with. And that is, you know, if you follow it through to its logical conclusion, that is designed that way because it takes you then to the Appropriations Act, which sets out the actual spending authority for the departments through the budget process. So this answer is by way of, I think, of a rationale about how why the situation is the way it is, how it's sort of grown up to be that way. And I do think that moving to a consolidated revenue approach is something that we have to look at in the department in terms of the budgeting process, because it would require us to do a different budgeting process, which would then require additional resources and those sorts of things. So those are the kinds of, I think, conversations that I'm trying to pursue around the best approach. When I did my opening comments, I mentioned that we have an unqualified opinion on the public accounts. So it is the difference between the budget and the public accounts, but the public accounts are complete and unqualified and very transparent and provide the information to Nova Scotians. So it isn't that we don't deal with this information. It's just the manner in which we deal with it right now. So if you would permit, I would like Byron to just talk very briefly about some of the sort of the issues that we have in terms of trying to implement the recommendation.
Mr. Rafius.
Thank you. As you pointed out, the Deloitte report did provide, I think, four options of which this issue could be addressed, and each of those options have a different level of complexity to them. And the recommended option in the Deloitte report, as in the Auditor General's recommendation, is not so much as full consolidated revenue, which would have a major impact on the budgeting process for the province, but as an inclusion of a list of attached revenues from those outside entities. The difficulties that lie with that is, first of all, is to provide enough review evidence for those amounts at the time of the preparation of the estimate. Some of those amounts are not known, and that would lead to the necessity maybe to, in some people's mind, to include them. But really the focus of the estimate, as the deputy said, is to talk about providing spending authority to allow funds to flow out of the Consolidated Revenue Fund through the Appropriations Act. And the inclusions of these revenues and the associated expenses to those, and if you notice in the budget, there is an assumption that these revenues and estimates are equal and offsetting and have no effect on the bottom line. In fact, there is a reconciliation provided in the public accounts where you can see that the format for the two, either including them or not including them, results in the same bottom line. That the inclusion of these may be confusing to the reader. It was a concern from the fiscal community that you're talking about revenues of which the expenditures are not voted on in the House. And that would lead to, in some people's mind, a difficulty understanding the bottom line. And so that's one of the reasons why it's a struggle to provide them there. As well, too, it's really the focus of the estimates being the accountability of the government, which is the accountability of the funds going into the Consolidated Revenue Fund. So from that perspective, there is some difficulties getting at. Now, the other prospect is, as I said, the difficulty to know some of these in advance. Some of them are quite well known and from previous years. They don't change a lot. But some of them, these entities that we consolidate, do have other activities, other revenue sources. If you recall in previous sessions when I talked about the revenues of the parent or the revenues of the children, we're really talking about the revenues of the children here. Those activities may not be well established, then it would be difficult to actually produce a document that would be meaningful to the group or to the House.
Mr. Younger.
Thank you. You've talked about appropriations and spending, and I think that's the problem in the province, is that we focus all about how we can spend the money and not on what's coming in on the other side. And that's not a criticism of you individually. That's just the way that that's probably why governments around the world have gotten to the mess they've gotten into. And from my perspective, the public accounts are probably challenging for a lot of Nova Scotians to read as it is at the best of times. And so I don't think there's not a strong argument, in my view, to not include them just because it will make it more complicated to read and understand the bottom line, because I think that, you know, the whole reason we had a session there a few weeks ago was so that, you know, the people in this room could figure out how to read what we have. And in terms of the timelines, I think that's easily solved by just transitioning to that move over a number of years and requiring those entities to report. But if we are asking legislators to come into the legislature and every spring and approve a budget without which includes obviously handing money over to some of these entities in some cases, or it approves departmental revenues, some of which may transition, may flow down to some of these reporting entities, then we should also know what those revenues are that are coming in, because otherwise we don't actually have a full picture of the financial liabilities and so forth of the province. And that's what's concerning to me, is that we end up with a very incomplete picture at the end of the year. I was happy to hear the deputy say that, you know, sort of looking at how this might happen. I do appreciate that. How is it? Do you think it's fair for legislators and Nova Scotians to be asked to approve and give comment on a budget each year, regardless of the government, if they don't have a full picture of what the revenues and expenses are of all of the entities that encompass provincial liabilities?
Ms. McDonald?
I think, you know, I appreciate your question and I appreciate the concerns. And as I said earlier, I'd really like to kind of take a dive into this and see, you know, if there are ways that we can deal with the issue. So that may be the best that I can say in response to that. There are other avenues of information, Mr. Rafius has said, these are sort of children of the larger entity, which doesn't excuse accountability by any means, but they have different processes. They are, to some extent, semi-autonomous, and they do produce their own documentation that outlines their budget, their revenue, their expenditures in their business plans and that sort of thing. So there are other avenues to obtain the information in terms of accountability. And then, of course, we provide all of it in the public accounts at the end of the day. So I would say that there's not the information is available. But again, having said that, I appreciate the question, and I'm not able to give you a full response to it other than to say that we'd certainly try and continue to work to some resolution.
All right. Well thank
Younger.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I mean, I before getting in this role, I've sat on the boards of some of these organizations, so I'm familiar with them, whether it's the Bridge. I was on the Bridge Commission for a few years, for example, and a lot of these debts and bonds, although they float their own, they're often, in some cases, guaranteed by the province in a roundabout way, or they are approved by the Minister of Finance. The Bridge Commission, for example, they have to get it signed off by the Minister of Finance. And I can tell you, we talk about parents and children a lot in terms of how this works. If I was co-signing a loan for my son, you rest assured that I would want to know the revenues and expenses. So, yep. You know, that whole parent-child argument to me is actually the perfect argument of why I would want to know it, because I wouldn't just be signing a blank check for my kid. I want to ask also about the petroleum revenue issue, and this one's intriguing to me, because a number of months back we had another Auditor General chapter which, in a nutshell, if I recall it correctly, talked about, well, I can't really audit and tell you whether the safety standards are being followed, and obviously that's not your department, because this claim of proprietary information. And the federal Auditor General at the time, if I recall correctly, was saying, listen, this whole propriety thing is really a red herring, because Auditor Generals can keep things confidential and they should still be able to audit them. And frankly, the royalty revenues are the property of Nova Scotians. So how are we going to address that petroleum revenue issue?
Ms. McDonald?
I had an opportunity to look at the discussion that occurred when the Auditor General appeared before this committee in just the last couple of weeks. And I was really intrigued by the discussion, because I believe what the Auditor General and the staff were saying, the report itself, I think, suggests, the Auditor General's report and the recommendation, I think, suggested, or we certainly understood, that we were talking about an independent third-party review. And I think that's when you have issues associated with the proprietary information, because it's bringing somebody else else in to have a look at information that typically is provided to us on a very confidential basis. But in looking at the comments, I understood that the Auditor General and the Assistant Auditor General to say that the independent review wasn't necessarily where they were placing their emphasis. So that was a new sort of opening on this issue to me. Again, I don't want to sit here and say, well, we're going to have a conversation and try and put you off. But I thought that was an interesting sort of change in the discussion, or at least perhaps a misunderstanding on our part. And I understood some of the comments to be saying it doesn't necessarily have to be an independent person. It's really about controls inside the office. So I think that's an area that we can explore with the Auditor General to see if there is some room for us to deal with this particular recommendation and our current inability or concerns, at least, around implementing it.
Mr. Younger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I could ask the Auditor General to respond to that, because that, if that's appropriate.
To the point?
Certainly, I can say that this office has never, in any discussions with the Department of Finance, recommended a review by a third party outside of government. The recommendation, as has been discussed with them, has been that another party within the Department of Finance, even, who was not involved in the initial work, review the work. It's equivalent to a quality assurance review. Everything that we do in our office is subject to an independent review by someone else in the office. And that's a quality assurance function. That's what we're referring to. It's really fairly simple.
Mr. Younger?
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. LaPointe, because I think that that's important, and I think that that's an eminently reasonable request, and I'm glad that you're going to be looking into that. And I hope that I know you sort of joke that some of the answers would be we're going to look into this and approaching the thing, and maybe, Mr. Chair, we'll have to bring people back in a few months to see whether things, where we've come down the road, because I certainly want to give you the benefit of the doubt that they will be looked into and addressed. But if they're not addressed, I think we have a major issue. Petroleum resources in particular, whether it's offshore, onshore, those royalties are up and down, and it's often seems like a guessing game for the public to have some transparency around that. I think I probably only have 14 seconds left. Oh, it's 1 minute? All right. I'll just leave it to this since we only have a minute. How do you deal with the issue of proprietary information, whether it's petroleum resources or otherwise, in terms of providing accountability to the legislature, but also addressing what you feel? Where's the balance?
Ms. McDonald?
This is probably one of the primary instances of that. I'd probably look to Byron for some confirmation of that. But so this is probably the primary issue, and I think it is a particularly serious issue because we are a small province, and sometimes we can't release information in the aggregate because we have. So some industries are small enough that even in the aggregate, it's fairly easy to determine who the information belongs to or what the information relates to. So there is an issue there, and I guess we simply do our best, to try and protect that information and balance that with accountability and with transparency. And I guess coming back to this issue, and I
order,
certainly
please.
Don't...
Oh. Time has expired. Mr. McMaster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're coming towards the end of the 2011-12 fiscal year. Should we expect any surprise surpluses?
We'll be doing a forecast for 2011-12 with the budget. That's probably about the most information that I can provide to you today in terms of the position of the province.
Okay. Go ahead. Sorry. And I respect if you can't provide more than that, but have there been any budget items, either on the revenue side or the expense side, that appear to be substantially different from the budget that was approved last spring?
Ms. McDonald?
We issued a forecast in December, which did indicate that there were some changes at that point in time, and in particular, we had some... prior year adjustments with respect to our revenues, but at that point in time, expenditures were certainly certainly well within budget. So I think we'll have to wait for the forecast as it comes out with the budget this spring to be able to define to you any particular changes, but we certainly did prepare a complete forecast of all known issues at the time in December.
Okay.
Mr. McMaster. Yeah.
Thank you. One of the items that the government's been working on is, or that they said they were going to be working on, is reducing the number of full-time equivalents by 1,000. Can you report any progress on how that's been going?
Again, we will report on that in the budget this year.
Okay.
It is one of the measures that we typically put our FTEs into the budget documents, and we would continue to report on that when we bring out the budget material this year as well.
Okay.
Mr. McMaster?
I've noticed in previous years that the estimates and the actual number of FTEs, there's quite a bit of variance. And I know departments that like to hang on to their FTEs because it gives them an ability maybe to take on new projects or move in new directions. And if they have the FTE approved in the budget, well, they have some power to be able to do things without, I guess it gives them some flexibility. And I know departments like that. I guess on the other side of it, for a government that's trying to balance the budget, to make sure that we're able to have things. I can think of something in my area as small as, it's small as a budget item, but it's important for the people of the area, is the emergency surgery at the hospital in Inverness. Recently, that's been eliminated, and I know people are very upset about it. And I guess I kind of link the two together. You know, sometimes there are decisions that, say, the District Health Authority might need to make in conjunction with a requirement to reduce its budget. And then when I'm scouring the budget of the province, when you see FTE counts and departments are able to keep that flexibility of keeping the FTEs on their books, it's almost allowing the government to pad its budget a bit. Is there any way that the Department of Finance tracks that number? Because I know it's a fairly significant cost for government.
Ms. McDonald?
So you're talking about tracking the FTE number? We produce that number in the budget documents. The Department of Finance itself doesn't actually manage or track that number as such. That would be Public Service Commission in conjunction with Treasury Board. Mm-hmm. So, but we would certainly publish it in our documentation. That's probably the best answer. And in terms of details around that particular initiative, it would be more of an initiative associated with the Public Service Commission and, to some extent, Treasury Board.
Sure, I respect that.
Mr. McMaster?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we've had them here before, and I've asked them that question as well. So,
okay.
But just wanted to check to see what kind of connection there'd be between the two departments. I guess one of the big, and I guess the reason I'm talking about human resources in government is it makes up a big component of the budget. If you look at the salaries and benefits across government, it's probably somewhere in the order of maybe 70. Would you say it's about 70-80% of the cost of government?
Mm-hmm. Byron says yes, so I say
okay.
Yes.
Okay. And I know everybody is the same. We all would like to earn more money, and we can't blame people for that. That's only natural. But I guess one of the things we've been seeing lately is school boards and district health authorities being asked to reduce their budgets to bring the provincial budget back into line, to bring it into balance. And I guess, have you any comment on labor contracts that have been signed the last couple of years and those coming up in the near future and their impact on the budget?
Ms. McDonald?
I guess my only comment would be, it is a fact that most of the services that the government provides are provided through people, you know, and it does create, it is a large part of our budget, there's no question, but that's simply how many of the services get delivered. But from a labor perspective, again, it isn't an issue that we manage at the Department of Finance. I'd certainly hesitate to speak at any length about it. But again, we're always interested, of course, in the financial results of any of the mm-hmm. discussions or negotiations that take place, because it does have a significant impact on where we are in any particular year in our finances. And pursuing, you know, a balanced budget, it becomes a significant issue, of course, because it it comprises such a large part of the budget. Yeah, clearly those are areas that, you know, government would be working on in order to achieve a balanced budget.
Sure.
Mr. McMaster.
And I can think of the school boards. I think 82% of their costs are wages and benefits. And would it be true that if the government makes a decision on labor contracts for the school boards and then asks the school board to find cuts within its budget, it's essentially asking that school board to find cuts within, say, 18% of that budget?
I really can't speak about the percentages.
Okay.
I think that to date, the discussions with the school boards have been focused very much on the declining number of students that we have in the system, and to the extent possible, the appropriate amounts of supports that should be around that declining demographic. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is the effort that the Department of Education has undertaken with the school boards around the budget imperatives that are there.
Yes, and I'm certainly seeing that in my area, the area I represent. We've seen declining enrollments for years now, and it's tough because the school boards have assets that were built for X number of students, and now there's less students. And they have to, the costs don't change.
Yep.
And I know that the department tries to support rural students by adding a bit of an extra amount in the funding formula per student to recognize that. Yep. I guess what it comes down to for me, though, I guess I wonder who comes first. Like, are we putting people first or government first? And I know that's not really a question to ask here at Public Accounts, but I guess it's something that runs through my mind when I'm thinking about the human side of all these numbers. Over the next 5 years, I know that there's labor contracts come up at different points in time. Can you give some commentary on the impact on the budget that we look at today based on those future contract settlements and what impact they could have on the finances of the province?
I can't really be specific about that because it's future oriented and unresolved. So, you know, there may be a calculation somewhere that, you know, I might be able to provide that says for every, you know, increase in labor costs or increase in the payments for labor, it would amount to X pressure on the budget. I think that's just a given, you mm-hmm. know. And as I said, a lot of our services are delivered through people, so it is always of concern, of course, about the extent to which we increase our labor costs and the impact mm-hmm. of that on the budget. I mean, that's simply a consideration for people like Byron and myself in the role that we have, which is to receive the information to try and determine the impact on the fiscal plan. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the go forward, I really am not in a position to speculate about where that might go. It's a matter for discussion at a lot of other tables, particularly, I would think, collective bargaining tables, likely where a lot of that discussion will take place.
Mr. McMaster.
Sure. Yesterday I sat on the Human Resources Committee, and we had the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, and they were kind of making the point that a lot of the small business owners sometimes are having difficulty attracting people to work in their businesses because they're competing with the government for their workers, and I guess in their case they're limited by how much they can pay based on how much revenue they can generate in their business, how many sales, how much sales activity they can generate, and so on. In the case of government, I guess it's only we're only limited by the amount of taxation. So if we increase the HST, it gives us added ability to pay those higher wages and whatnot. I guess just moving towards, you know, when we've seen budgets that haven't been balanced and we see the incurrence of... actually, before I move on to the debt, I guess I just want to... I want to ask one other question here. In 2010, in the public accounts, salaries and fringe benefits totaled just under $730 million. And in 2011, they totaled about $755 million. Which would be about a 3.4% increase. Now, I respect I should be referencing those numbers for you, but I guess the point is it seems like the cost of government is increasing in this area, which is right across government. Would it be fair to say then that instead of decreasing the cost of government, we've actually, over the last couple of years, seen an increase in the cost of government?
Ms. McDonald?
I think I'd probably need a bit more specifics around the question in order to really answer the question for you. The budget documentation that we filed last year and the work that's being done at Treasury Board indicates that government is taking a really serious approach to expenditure reduction. That's really my primary comment there. We're looking at all areas of government where we can reduce expenditures appropriately in order to get back to balance. But we always have to balance that exercise with the reality that in some cases costs are going to rise for a whole variety of reasons, not necessarily related to labor costs. In the healthcare system, for instance, utilization, just the number of people who are coming in to the system to use it, that's really a matter beyond the control of anyone. So you can see fluctuations there. If I thought longer, I could give you other examples of heating costs in schools. There are various areas where we have to take into account that we simply can't keep all of those costs under control. So I would have to go back, I think, and look at the various areas that you're talking about and look into it a bit deeper in order to give you a proper answer to the question.
Sure.
But I think it's fair to say that while we are making a lot of progress, really, in trying to get spending under control, there are some things that we simply have to recognize that that don't lend themselves to that exercise very well.
Sure, sure. It's funny, I think of another example. I was talking to somebody 2 days ago, and their children are picked up on a secondary road, but it's to the point now where the school board requires them to walk an extra kilometer to save a few dollars, I guess. And I just think it's kind of sad that it kind of gets to that point where a young child going to school has to walk, and sometimes they're young children, and in the rural area, parents are worried about coyotes and things like that. And I just find it's a very small example, but it kind of puts it into perspective, the trade-offs. And I guess one of the ways that the government has chosen to bring the budget back into balance is by increasing the HST. How much revenue has that generated? From the 2% increase, it's quite sizable, the extra revenue that it's generated. Maybe you could provide some numbers around that.
Mr. Rafius?
I can provide you the absolute value of the HST, but the actual change per the 2% point, I'd have to get back to you on that. I don't think I have that with me.
Okay.
I know what it was projected, but if you look at the public accounts in the revenue section, and I will, as I talk very slowly here.
Sure.
I will find that, that amount.
I think it's somewhere in the order of 400 or 500 million, is it?
There you go. The increase, or I just have the total, sorry, of the
total. I guess what I'm trying to, the figure I'm trying to hit at is the, when our provincial portion of the HST was 8%, and now it's 10%, that 2% increase,
yeah.
How many dollars is that extra dollars is bringing into the budget every year?
I would have to get back to you on the actual, the increase, but the overall size of the HST, our revenues is about $1.5 billion overall.
$1.5
so
billion.
Part of that would be the increase in the points, but we can get back to you on that.
Right, okay. So it's, I guess if you took a fifth of that, and I don't, again, it's maybe not fair, but given that that it's been increased by 25%, you'd probably be looking at, was it 1.3 you said total?
The total is about 1.5. Last year's actions.
Okay. So it's probably, it could be somewhere in the order of about $300 million extra dollars that are coming in. So there's, and I guess we've done some numbers on the increase, and it works out to about $430 per every person in the province, extra amount that's coming into government. So that's one thing that the government has chosen to do. The other thing, I guess, is they've chosen to do is add to the debt by running deficit budgets. And I know the Auditor General has raised it recently, and I know there was a member on the committee here took great offense to it. And used all his time to basically say to the Auditor General, you know, who asked you? It's not appropriate for you to give commentary on the ethics of adding debt. And I guess what I see in that is somebody who's greatly bothered and maybe whose conscience is bothered by the fact that they're adding a lot of debt to the province. Because I think we all know that it ultimately we don't have a good record in the province of going back and repaying debt that we incurred years ago. I think we started incurring deficit budgets before I was born, and we've seen very few times when the province has actually gone back and tried to repay that debt. I guess what concerns me going forward is that, you know, the politicians come and go. I think our average lifespan is 7 years, but we're long gone when it comes time to go back and pay for the decisions we've made. And we've talked about the value of that, and we've actually tried to introduce legislation here to make the legislature recognize when it's approving, we'll be approving a budget pretty soon here in a few weeks' time, to make us aware of the impact that we're having on future generations. I guess I should move towards a question. How would you characterize the Department of Finance's relationship with the Auditor General?
Ms. McDonald?
I think it's very professional. I think, you know, we have a good working relationship, frankly, that, you know, we have good, what would you call them, interesting discussions by times around various issues. But my sense certainly is that there's a good deal of respect on both sides between the staff of the Department of Finance and mm-hmm. at the Auditor General's office.
Mr. McMaster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's good to hear, and it's understandable there might be some competitive tension, and that's probably a good thing, as the Auditor General's role is to hold, of course, the government to account to make sure that things are being done accurately and suitably. maybe not to stir the pot, but perhaps the Auditor General might like to offer some commentary on the relationship of his office with the Department of Finance.
Mr. LaPointe.
Well, certainly I'd be glad to, and I would agree with the Deputy Minister that we have a good working professional relationship with the Department and have for a considerable period of time. We have differences of opinion and disagreements and tensions, as you characterize it, and that's to be expected. But nevertheless, I would say that it's a good working professional relationship.
Thank you.
McMaster.
Thank you. Well, that's good to hear. In the chapter that in the recent report that we've been looking at about financial indicators, the Auditor General talks about sustainability. Does the department feel the province's current debt position is sustainable?
Ms. McDonald.
Our role at the Department of Finance is
order, please. Time has expired, unfortunately.
Darn.
Mr. McKinnon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It's great to have you here this morning to answer some questions. And first, I'd like to begin with a comment in relationship to questioning by the member for Inverness. It's my understanding that the debt has, in fact, been paid down only 7 times in the last 50 years. Could you tell us when the last time that was?
Ms. McDonald.
I'm just going to refer that to Byron for the technical details.
Mr. Rayfuse.
I believe the measure you're looking at is reduction in the net debt, and the reduction in the net debt actually did occur last fiscal year, where the all-inclusive measure of your debt position, which is we refer to net debt, is which is beyond just your immature your bonds that you have floated to finance your operation, but also takes into account your pension obligations and other other liabilities. Last year did note a decrease in that amount.
Mr. McKinnon.
Thank you very much. In relationship to the debt, it's my understanding that the debt is in the order of $13 billion. And can you give us a more exact figure?
Mr. Rafius.
The net debt as of last March 31st was $12.8 billion.
Mr. McKinnon.
And as a comment, it's my understanding that three-quarters of that debt, that current debt, is attributable to conservative governments over the years, and one-quarter of it to liberal governments. So I just want to put that on the
Mr.
table.
Mr. Rafius.
Now, to begin with the Finance Act, the Department of Finance is accountable to the public. It's accountable to the legislature, of course, but more importantly to the people of Nova Scotia. And there are a number of mechanisms by which we or you are accountable to the people of Nova Scotia. Can we sort of deal with those one at a time, beginning with perhaps the estimates themselves?
Ms. McDonald?
Yes, I mean, generally speaking, we, as I said earlier, primarily we provide the budget based on the on the Consolidated Revenue Fund, and we work with Treasury Board to develop the expenditures associated with that, and then we present that budget to the House each year. So again, that leads to the statutory authorization for departments to spend money. So it is a long-standing, one of the probably the highest accountabilities that we have as a department to prepare those materials for the minister to take into the House, and it provides Nova Scotians hopefully with as clear a picture as we have about the state of the province's finances. And I guess I would refer you in that respect to some of the documentation that we prepare around our budget. Had an opportunity to look back on it as I was preparing to come and appear before the committee, and it's very extensive, it's very professional, you know, if we want to use the transparency and accountability words, I think there's a lot of information there for Nova Scotians should they want to take advantage of the material that we publish at budget time. As we go through the year, we are required under the Finance Act then to report on a public basis the status of that particular budget as we go through the year. So in September and in December, typically we provide what we call forecast updates. So again, we provide the public with an update of all of the information that we have at that particular point in time, both on the revenue side and on the expenditure side, as well as capital side, as well as any sort of adjustments to economic assumptions that we see, or any issues associated with our budget that may be happening out in the public. So we have that accountability, and again, through the minister presents that material to the public on those bases. We then do a third forecast on the particular budget year as we go into the next budget. So we would forecast, we would put a full forecast into for that particular year into the budget, and then we follow up with the public accounts, the audit of the public accounts. And again, I think the Auditor General has recognized the efforts that the department has put into that. We used to have the public accounts coming out quite late in the following fiscal year. That was moved up by statute to come out by the end of September. And what we've done through practice, which includes both the Auditor General's office and the Department of Finance office, is a real effort to get those financial statements out as soon as possible to the public once the year end has occurred. So I think last year it was the end of July that we had those public accounts out for the public. So that's our cycle of information that we provide to the public.
Mr. McKinnon?
Well, that's an excellent point, because I'd like to follow up on that a bit. I note in Chapter 2 that the audit opinion on public accounts for 2010-11 was positive, unqualified, and that the government was commended for producing these documents significantly earlier than the legislated deadline of September the 30th. How were you able to achieve this important improvement?
Mr. McDonald?
I think I would have to compliment the Auditor General's office, because it is as much a piece of work for the Auditor General's office as it is for us to engage upon the audit of the public accounts. So it's definitely something that we have both, I think, achieved. And it's really, I think, no less than saying that a lot of people have actually made this a priority and have worked towards getting these accounts done as in as timely a way as we can, ensuring that we're meeting all of the requirements. So it really was a conscious decision, in my understanding, for both offices to say that it's really appropriate for us to get these out as quickly as we can. People have committed to that, and I think you're seeing the results of that now.
Mr. McKinnon.
Thank you. I would like to commend the department for doing such a good job, and certainly the government is pleased that it has been able to make these documents available to the public in a timely fashion. I'd like to sort of look back in history for a little while, and when were these documents historically released?
Mr. McDonald?
In previous years. Let's look back at previous years and do a little documentation on when they were done in the past.
I'll ask Mr. Rafuse to respond to some of those.
Mr. Rafuse?
Thank you. Just before I answer that question, the notion of moving these forward, as the deputy has indicated, is a major undertaking. This involves a lot of planning, not only by the Office of the Controller and the Government Accounting, but the Auditor General's Office. We're actually planning for this does usually start in the January or maybe December timeframe of the year before, where we agree on certain deliverable timelines and dates. So the notion that when we were thinking about switching it, because as the deputy indicated earlier, in previous years, we were getting into late into the fall. I think there was even a post-Christmas one at one point. So the legislation was changed to September 30th. I don't recall the exact date of that, to be honest with you, but it remained to be a struggle to achieve that deliverable. So about 4 years ago, and maybe 5 years ago, we decided challenge the staff to come up with a plan to present to the Auditor General about moving that forward. I actually thought the expectation was that we would try to move it to August the 31st. They did come forward with a very robust plan, actually, to move it to July the 31st, to my surprise. So that was since my tenure as a controller, which began in 2005. Since that time, we have been achieving the end of July release, or at least to be ready for it. We did move that a bit during election year, because it was just the timing around that was not appropriate, so we did get into the August timeframe. But that move to July 31st, which is our planning date, occurred about 4 years ago, and we've achieved it every year since.
Thank you. I commend you for that. The recommendations made in Chapter 3, many of them have already been implemented. Could you perhaps look at them one by one and give us at least the most important ones, indicate which ones have in fact been implemented to date?
Mr. Rafuse?
Certainly, let's look at these recommendations. And just to give by way of background, and the chapter does speak to this, this is actually a follow-up to a review that occurred in 2004. where the governance and controls around our liability management section, and then at that point our investment management sections were reviewed. It was a qualified review because of really the inability to test controls, because a lot of controls weren't in place, to be honest with you. So since that time, there's been a great amount of work being put in place to establish not only the governance policies that are needed to manage the debt, but actually to set up the internal infrastructure to do so, and provide appropriate separations of duties within those functions. And you'll see in this document language about front office, middle office, and back office functionalities. And the front office is really the people that do the investments and do the trades, and they're the ones in which the policies are developed and approved through the debt management committee and ultimately by the minister, that gives them the guidance about what kinds of risks are appropriate, what types of instruments are allowable, and the types of credit risks they're allowed to take. The middle office function, which is established on this, is really what I often refer to as on-time, real-time auditing. They actually review every trade as it occurs to make sure not only does the front office follow the policies, but the back office, and this is really the nuts and bolts accounting of it, that the actual trades or initiatives have been duly or properly recorded in time. And they have an obligation. If they're not, they now have to report that to the management structure of the department. So that's really what this this original audit was all about, where they cited the deficiencies. And this latest chapter is the work that the Auditor General did in conjunction with an external audit firm to actually come in and test. Not only did we have all the recommendations from the renewal review in place that had already been established by what I call a pre-audit done by our internal audit section, to see whether or not all those procedures that are in place are working effectively. And we were quite pleased because we actually thought we had achieved some major strides here, that those controls were effective, and the governance of the debt, of the management of the liability section was adequately put in place. I was going to sort of go to the recommendations now, where as was all organizations, it's always great to have an independent review of looking at how you do things. You may think you've achieved an objective. A lot of these recommendations stem from, I wouldn't call them concerns about overarching controls, because those were, as the audit report says, were quite adequate and they were quite pleased. We're more on the finer details, especially around some reconciliation issues and some separation of duties issues. We do have a relatively small shop there, to be honest with you, and sometimes it's difficult in any shop that's small to have appropriate segregation of duties. So you really have to do some what we refer to as over compensating controls on top of those responsibilities by individuals to ensure that adequate controls are in place and that the policies are achieved. So really the recommendation is 3.1 talks about a calculation of an interest coming out of our custodial reports. The custodian, by the way, is we have a relationship with a third party who actually holds all our and sinking funds and holds our assets in the market, so that it's independent from us. We did change custodians last year, and we're quite pleased that our the reports we get out of that new provider is much more robust, and that the calculations needed to, as referenced in 3.1 around our sinking funds interests, are the changes were put in place, and we're quite pleased with that. The 3.2 talks about a reconciliation and documentations, and really, I think if I recall correctly, something was referred to a reconciliation that shouldn't have been referred to as a reconciliation, and we have changed that process as well. And if you look at the chapter itself on page 46, it actually talks about the relationship and how we do provide separations of duties. You can see that the liability management section reports directly to the deputy, but which is the front office, as I spoke to earlier, but the middle and back office report up through the controller, and we are really the checks and balances on the system. 3.3 on the chapter talks about the complete of the risk assessments on the roles and responsibilities, ensure controls exist to mitigate identified risk. They do provide that we believe that risk and the roles and responsibilities positions that within a division should be prepared and identified to ensure risks are sufficiently mitigated. We do believe we have a process in place that we did make some finer tune adjustments to address that concern as well. And recommendation 3.4 talks about the ability for people that are in what we refer to as our Millennium system, which is a system we use to produce all our tickets as our confirmation that a trade or an investment has been made. There was an ability for people to change the limits on that, we have sort of tightened that down a bit so that people can't do that without an appropriate authorization. And then finally, I think on 3.5, we talk about the administrator role, which is really the director of compliance and reporting, where they need the recommendations that they should only have read-only access. Their role requires them to have a bit more, so we're still kind of working through the processes. And I would say there we're going to put some compensating controls in place so when that individual needs to have access more than read it, and that they can do so. I think, no, there's a couple more recommendations, but they are ones on which we have implemented, and I think that they're pretty self-explanatory.
Mr. McKinnon.
Thank you. I think Chapter 3 does make it abundantly clear that significant strides have been made by the department to improve governance and control frameworks, particularly in regards to liability management and treasury services and capital markets administration. All of this since the 2004 denial of an audit opinion. What was the most significant change in the governance and control framework since the audit of 2004, where there was a denial of an audit opinion?
Mr. Rafuse?
I would say there's probably two significant changes. The actual establishment of a middle office and back office function, where we actually created an infrastructure to allow appropriate separations of duties. That a back office accounting function usually actually be embedded right in the liability management side, so there's actually almost the same staff performing that function, which was not appropriate. And we actually established the middle office or the compliance function since that. It's a new role. So that, I would say, was the one. The other thing is the role of the Debt Management Committee in establishing appropriate policies and to identify the appropriate risk tolerances that the liability management folks must adhere to. That is a robust process. We have not only representatives from outside of the department on the Debt Management Committee. We have an independent from outside of government that sits on that committee. The Deputy Minister does chair that committee and provides recommendations on governance and also procedural policies for approval from the Minister. That was not in place beforehand, and so there wasn't an overarching governance structure beforehand. So those two things together, I would say, were the two most significant things that have been put in place.
Can you tell us...
Order, please. Time has expired. Mr. Younger, we have 8 minutes.
8 minutes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just make a very quick comment. Mr. McKinnon is absolutely right that there was a debt payoff in the last year. Of course, we all know that the net debt is up since 2009 when the NDP took office, and the largest single debt payment in Nova Scotia's history was under a Liberal government. So the fact is, I mean, at the end of the day, we can get into this debt debate, but there is every There is no party that has is guiltless in adding to the debt of this province. I'm not going to sit here and say Liberal governments haven't been. I mean, that would be ridiculous. And Tory governments haven't been. And the current NDP government isn't. And we had a bunch of minority governments where people were horse trading for, and many of the people sitting here today weren't there during the minority governments, but were horse trading and to keep governments alive. And while minority governments often have benefits, in some respects, they can often be very expensive as well, because money sometimes gets spent and added to the debt on the part of all the parties in the legislature during that time. And I think we all need to recognize that that is the fact, and that there are all parties and all members bear some responsibility. And frankly, to some extent, members of the public who, on the one hand, come demanding lower taxes and lower fees, and then also at the same time, in the second breath, want to know why the services haven't increased or why they don't have a special service. And so it's an important discussion that actually we actually have to have that important and honest discussion at some point with the public. I would like I only have a few minutes, so I'd like to draw your attention to page 78 and 79 of the Auditor General's report. And there's something I couldn't find clearly in the report, and maybe is or maybe is not in the report, but it says there were 11 recommendations, and we see it in the chart, that the government does not intend to implement. So 11 recommendations. Now, my understanding and reading in this is submitted responses, and there were four of them that the Auditor General said, oh, you know, you make a good case. I'm summarizing, of course, Mr. Chair. Make a good case, so we see your point, so we're not going to track those. But at the end of the day, there were seven where there's a disagreement between the Department of Finance, or the government, mostly Department of Finance, and the Auditor General's office. I'm going to guess that one of those is the consolidated revenue issue that we discussed. So that leaves six. I'm just trying to find out which six recommendations does the government not intend to implement that the Auditor General's office still feels are important to implement.
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you for the question. Each year, so if you look at the list, each year, like the June 05 report would have made the recommendations on the consolidated revenue issue, and then it would have been repeated in subsequent reports. So in fact, I didn't actually do the math, but most of those seven, I think, would be repeats of the issue associated.
So the same recommendation over and over.
I think Byron's telling me that it's about four out of the seven. Would be, again, associated with the same issue around consolidated revenue.
Mr. Younger?
All right. And what are the other three, then?
We'll have to...
Mr. Rafuse?
You knew I wasn't going to let you get away with that.
I can provide that to you. We didn't bring that status report to you. I thought the detail was actually in here as to what they were, but... they result from other audits, some of which are governance or control-based audits, but I can provide you those actual findings and the explanation we did give to them as to why we're not recommending them or not implementing them.
No, that's fine. Oh, sorry.
Mr. Younger.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I forgot to let you recognize me there.
That's all right.
There's a reason I ask is because there may be very good reasons and very debatable reasons why something's not going to be implemented. I think we all understand the consolidated revenue one, whether we agree with you. I don't agree with your position. I sort of saw, if I'm going to pick sides, I'm going to pick the Auditor General's side on that one. But if that's four, then we understand what that one is. But I think it's important for the public and us as legislators to know which recommendations the government doesn't feel that they or doesn't agree with and why that is. So that is something that I would appreciate coming forward another time, and we may choose to call that back if there's an issue. I want to get back to this petroleum revenue issue, since I don't have a lot of time and so really don't have time to move on to something entirely different. We see the royalties, and at the moment they're declining, but hopefully maybe with the Shell deal they might go up and so forth over time. Are those revenues currently being calculated on a gross production basis or a net production basis, or do you know?
Mr. Rafuse?
Sorry, I need to get back to you.
That's fine. All right, and you may have to get back to me on this too. There's a reason that I want to know is because under the onshore royalty regime, there's effectively a holiday for the first couple of years of production, which they call exploration. And then after that, the royalties are calculated on a very net basis. I know there's no such thing as very net, but I call it a very net basis because you can take off a lot of expenses which before paying the royalty rate that you wouldn't when you report to the Securities and Exchange Commission you wouldn't take off the same revenues, which strikes me as an issue because it results in potentially less royalty revenue to the province. And what I'd like to know, and if you can't answer this right now, it's fine, you can get back to us, is whether that has been calculated into the royalty rate. So because we've allowed all kinds of reductions, are we asking for a higher royalty rate as a result to compensate for that?
Mr. Rayfuse?
No, I don't have that with me, but I will provide clarity on whether or not that is okay when I...
Okay, thank you. I think you understand why I'm concerned about that. Because, you know, I've said this many times in this house that from my perspective, the resources are ours and we should be the primary beneficiaries. And I understand why there are incentives and all that sort of thing. And there may be very good reasons for them, but I want to make sure that we're not getting shortchanged on the other end. I would also, if you don't know the answer, you can get back to us with information. How are those production models audited and whether those are audited in a public fashion? And the reason I ask is because I know that we're into this issue of whether it's proprietary or not, some of the information, but, you know, are we just taking John's Oil Company's word that what they're pulling out of the ground is exactly what they're pulling out of the ground? So how is that being audited? And I know that Exxon and all those guys are auditing it. There's no doubt they're auditing it. The question is, are we independently auditing it either in some fashion, and how is that happening?
And I take it,
Mr. Refuse.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, is it in regards to the actual that's recorded as opposed to the projection of the royalty that you're referring to? Because we do rely on audit material provided from those producers.
Order, please. Time has expired. The next thing, Mr. McMaster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can't let this little point on the debt go. I know we heard some comments earlier, but I just want to point out for anybody who's watching, the reason I asked my first question about a surprise surplus, if we were going to expect another one this year, was because last year we had a surprise surplus, and the government did make a payment on the debt, but they did it with an increased revenue source of increased taxes through the HST. But if we actually look at the debt that has been added to the book since they've taken power, they've added more debt per year than any administration in the history of the province, which I think is unethical. We can always look at the past, but what's important is what's happening right now and taking a principled stand on some of these things. I'm going to move towards some more questions. When the Auditor General presented his report to this committee in January, a member of this committee said, "Very interesting, but who asked you?" What role do you believe the Auditor General has in reviewing and commenting on the finances of the province?
Ms. McDonald.
I accept the report from the Auditor General. There's a reference there. I think we should note that it's not a report, as I noted earlier, that the Department of Finance participated in the development of. This was a report prepared by the Auditor General's office. He makes reference to preparing it in accordance with exposure draft, recommendation of standards and procedures around these particular issues. So I accept his report. He's indicated he has prepared it in order to incite assist people in engaging in the debate around the issue, and I certainly accept that as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Senator Master.
In my first round of questioning, I referenced a 3.4% increase in salaries and fringe benefits in the government that this government has chosen to make those increases. Since we see this increase, is the government justifying the claim of tightening our belts, I guess, by cutting frontline services like healthcare and educational professionals instead of upper level management.
Ms. McDonald.
I think what I can say in response to that is that any salary increases across government have been consistent in both the management and unionized environments. I'm not aware that there's any difference between the two.
Okay.
Mr. Castor.
Isn't it fair to say, though, that students and citizens' health is where the government is getting its savings for its claimed ethical financial conduct and belt tightening?
Ms. McDonald. Yeah.
The fiscal plan that was published in 2010, and which gets republished each year with the budget, has assumed, and we have implemented, substantial reductions through all government departments, as well as other entities which government funds out of the Consolidated Revenue Fund. So we could certainly provide you with you know, the detail around that as it gets implemented through the various budgets. And but I think that primarily the effort on expenditure management has been managed through Treasury Board. I certainly participate in a lot of that. And I would say that the effort to reduce expenditure in government and work towards a balanced budget appears to be something that we've asked just about every unit of government in every area to participate in, and there's certainly been some measured approach there as best we can do in trying to determine the impacts on people.
Mm-hmm. Mr. McMaster.
But I guess it does seem that the actual salaries and fringe benefits within government itself and the civil service are actually increasing.
Ms. McDonald.
I don't have the detail in front of me today. I could just tell you that there was a 1% increase in costs in salaries, which was implemented across all units of government. But on the other hand, we are looking at the number of FTEs and other expenditures in departments. So it would probably require a bit more analysis for me to actually come out definitively one way or the other on the bottom line on that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. McMaster.
The overall number of recommendations made in the Auditor General's report increased by 16%, by 23 recommendations over the previous year. 41% or 69 of the recommendations made in 2011 were repeated from 2010. Can you explain why the recommendations were not acted on?
Ms. McDonald.
Yeah, I guess it goes back to that question we had earlier about if you have a specific one, we could certainly look at it and come back to you with with more information about the issues that we have. We certainly try to implement as much as we can. I guess I'd like to emphasize the 76% completion rate as opposed to the ones that we haven't, but that's not necessarily how people look at these reports. But I think the 76% shows that, you know, we certainly take the recommendations seriously. We try to implement as much as we can. And if you want some more detail on those areas that currently, you know, we're either working on implementing or we're not able to implement, we would be very happy to provide you with some information around that.
Mr. McMaster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe that's something we could direct in writing to the department.
Okay.
I guess from a broader perspective, does the department intend to act on all of the recommendations contained in the report?
Ms. McDonald.
Well, I think it's fair. We've already indicated that we do not intend to implement in a number of areas. So I think if we could change that, and again, as I said earlier, I think around the that sort of inclusion of third-party revenues, I don't want to overstate, you know, the outcome of that, but we're certainly taking another look at it. We're talking about it. That, if that was no longer an issue, I think those statistics would improve substantially. Mm-hmm. We will do the best we can, and we will work as hard as we can to implement, but I think we've already made some determinations that we've been public about in terms of our ability to actually implement.
Okay. Mr. McMaster.
I know the member beside me here has talked a bit about it, member for Dartmouth East. In the Auditor General's report, The revenue estimates include all revenues of the consolidated entity, including all agencies' third-party revenues, in a schedule to ensure the budget is prepared and presented fully in accordance with Canadian generally accepted accounting principles. Can you give us, again, sort of the department's position on that recommendation?
Ms. McDonald.
This, again, as I said earlier, it's been a long-standing issue. It's been around for about 10 years, and we continue to talk about it. So we're going to continue to talk about it some more. We're going to try and see
order,
if we
please.
Can...
Order, please. Member's okay. Time has expired. Okay. Mr. McKinnon.
Thank you very much. I would just like to look at the need for stimulus funding in recent times. We have had decades of deficits or balanced budgets without any reduction in the overall debt of the province. A lot of the good times, there was money spent in every direction possible. And the need for stimulus funding, we have been dealing with a period that is, in fact, the world is dealing with a period that is, in fact, the greatest fiscal crisis since the Great Depression. And we, in fact, have had to match federal dollars. And we had to match federal dollars that the federal conservative government was racking up massive, massive deficits. And we put in, I don't know how many millions of dollars to stimulus funding. So my question is, do we exactly know how much we did spend to match those federal dollars?
Ms. McDonald?
I'll ask Byron, too.
Mr. Rafuse?
Certainly, during the capital planning for the last couple of years, there has been a number of programs that the federal government has put in place, of which required matching dollars from the province to take advantage of those. They have been primarily in the areas of the Build Canada Fund, which is on the primarily on the road construction side of the house, but also on some other information technology funds that were made available through their infrastructure program, which allowed us to either match or otherwise participate in those plans. Both of those plans, if you run those types of spending through your economic models, do have a positive impact, and therefore that's probably one of the primary reasons why they were selected for those infrastructure or those stimulus types programs. If we had not done that, we would not have been participating in those programs. That's an accurate statement, yes.
Mr. McKinnon?
Thank you. So we were, in fact, talking hundreds of millions of dollars.
Mr. Rafuse?
Certainly on the road construction side, we are talking hundreds of millions of dollars. We can actually provide for you the level of the funding that's been made available to those programs and our participation in, as I just have with me, but we, you are talking multi-millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Thank you very much. The rest of the time will be turned over to Mr. Ramey.
Mr. Ramey?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I just actually have a few questions. I think they're more for clarification than anything else. And they go back to the payment. There was a payment made on the debt recently or not that long ago. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
For the fiscal year last year, the net debt position did go down, yes.
And what was that? What was the payment that was made?
Since net debt is a kind of a very robust measure, it's really a result of having a surplus greater than your investment in TCA, where I'm going to simplify it, and that's really what resulted in that figure going being reduced.
Okay.
It's kind of different than repaying your bonds, and thus your debt.
Understood. Yes. Okay. Well, that's I guess probably why I didn't get it on the first go round. My second question is just after we. The present government took office, we had the H1N1 incident, and as did all provinces and in the country, so it wasn't unique to us. But is there any figure as to what that actually cost government? I mean, it wasn't a plan for expense. No one knew that we were going to hit that one. But do you have a rough idea of what that may have cost government?
Mr. Rafuse?
I don't have it with me, but I do know that there was tracking done both within the lead government department on that, which would have been the time would have been health protection, but also at the DHA level. There was obviously a lot of preparation costs and also deployment costs during that season. I don't have it, but I do know that they did some tracking on that.
Is it possible to get an estimate of that?
I can certainly ask the Department of Health to provide that. Okay.
Thank you very much. I'd just be interested in seeing what that actually did cost. The other thing is, and I don't know if I hope this is an appropriate question, but I mean we're one of three maritime provinces, and we're small, and I guess in many ways we're similar. You know, similar people, similar demographics, similar geography. I won't go on about it. Maybe similar debt levels. But in any event, I was just wondering, there's often a comparison made when I'm at various committee meetings and I'm listening to people present material at these committee meetings. They sometimes compare Nova Scotia to New Brunswick. And of course, there was the, and it's been brought up in the House, it's no secret. I mean, the issues related to cross-border shopping, particularly in the area where my colleague Mr. Scobar happens to be, and I'm just wondering, like in your deliberations and consultations and your thinking about how we're doing, do you look at all in comparisons between a province like ours and let's say our neighbor, our closest neighbor, I guess, because we're connected to it, New Brunswick? And I was just wondering if you do. If you have any information on where we stand here in Nova Scotia with regard to our debt-to-GDP ratio in relation to, for instance, New Brunswick and their debt-to-GDP ratio, and if they're similar or different.
Mrs. McDonald?
I would say generally yes. I mean, it is always useful information to look at what other provinces are doing. Although primarily for us, in terms of preparing the budget, we are much more... That may be a better question, I guess, for the minister, because for us, I mean, our particular role is certainly to have a look at the revenue and the expenditure and determine, you know, that we can sort of meet the imperatives that are put in front of us within sort of the construct that we have there. But I think I might refer you actually to the Auditor General's report in that respect regarding comparators around GDP and between Nova Scotia and other provinces. And I think he's outlined some of them here in the report. I would just have to find it here and make reference to it for you. Yeah, so...
Order, please. Time has expired for questioning. I would ask if the Deputy Minister would like to make any comments to wrap it up, and then we have some requests for information, a whole list of them here that I'll go through.
Okay. I really just simply like to thank the committee for their interest for their patience with us. We'll certainly try and provide any information that they need and would be happy to come back at any point if there's further clarification required. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to go through this rather lengthy list for today to make sure I have it all. If not, maybe the clerk can advise me if I've missed anything. There was a request for how much revenue the GST, the 2% increase in GST in dollars that the province has seen. And the clerk will send letters on all these, of course. The second item, would the Department of Finance provide a list of the items that the department disagrees with the Auditor General? And there was, in particular, was seven items. And I think you addressed a couple of those, but if you could list those as well. Next one was the petroleum revenues. And in conjunction with that was the royalty rates calculation of these, how that is done, the actual revenues and how they how they're issued. And also there was some questions around production models, how they're audited, how these are done, and I think a partial question was given that answer was given that, but not a complete answer. It was also another question on the details of the budget around salaries, and we'll go through the transcript to make sure we get that correct question. Funding of the infrastructure stimulus funding program in the province, what that did actually cost. The cost of N1H1 around that. And there was this one I believe was answered, but and I would ask the Mr. Ramey if indeed he did get a satisfactory answer on that, or I think it was Mr. Ramey, that was the debt to gross domestic product ratio compared to New Brunswick. Is that Mr. Ramey? Mr. Ramey?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I was satisfied with that answer. Thank you very much.
Satisfied? Okay, we'll take that one off the list. Now, is there anything else I've missed on that list? Okay, I think we have everything. Well, thank you very much, and I thank our guests for coming. And now we'll go back to Mr. D'Entremont to continue on with the discussion you started this morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Again, just to bring it back to light, that about $330,000 in taxpayers' dollars have gone towards an untendered contract. Of course, we know what that contract was for. The ship start here, it was designed to give this NDP government a credit for the shipbuilding contract that, of course, lobbying had absolutely no bearing on. We see the Premier's office fingerprints all over this. The Premier's Director of Policy and Community Relations used to work for the company that carried out the work, and we'd like to have him come and explain and answer questions on this questionable contract. And, of course, some of these things didn't come to light until an FOI or FOIPOC was done by the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. Of course, all that information is available online. And it did seem like until somebody asked the question, they didn't really do any of the work. So it looks like things were getting signed after the question was asked. So there's a lot of, some hanky-panky going on here that we'd like to have some questioning done. So again, I would move that we would have Mr. Paul Black, who is the Director of Director of Policy and Community Relations, come and maybe present the timeline for this contract and maybe answer some questions on behalf of government for the Ship Start Here contract.
Mr. Why Not?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I would ask that we, as a committee, take a 5 to 7 minute recess so that our caucus can consult on this motion, and then return when I would suspect we wouldn't we'd meet probably for about 5 to 7 minutes, but upon a return that the committee then make a decision if that's in course with what you would allow.
Yes, I will do that with concurrence of the other parties. But before we do that, I would also like to get agreement. If you take longer than this, it will continue past 11:30 to finish the discussion. Is that agreed?
Is
it agreed we take a 5 to 7 minute break right now? Thank you. Call the meeting to order again. Mr. Wynot.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and to the other committees, the other members of the committee, to allow us to have that recess. I appreciate that. Give our caucus an opportunity to have a chat. Mr. Speaker, our caucus will not be supporting the motion because we feel that the public procurement process was followed in regards to this. Mr. Chair, it's quite unfortunate that the opposition is not behind the shipbuilding contract. This is about making a confidence builder for Nova Scotia. This is a
order,
first
order,
time.
Please. Mr. Wynot has the floor. Mr. Wynot.
This is about ensuring that ShiftStart here was an unprecedented partnership between public, private, nonprofit organizations, as well as academic sectors. The cooperation, collaboration between over 70 organizations came on side to bring an awareness to this issue of ensuring that that Nova Scotia and the Irvings were awarded the contract from the federal government. And Mr. Chair, it's unfortunate that this is the way that they're going on this, and so we, our caucus, will not be supporting that motion.
Mr. Younger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would have probably not said much on this until Mr. Wynot's inflammatory statements there. Mr. Wynot knows full well that all parties of the legislature, including the Liberal caucus, supported the ShipStart Here program. In fact, I had a sign on my lawn and appeared with, I think Mr. Wynot was there, all parties went together to the shipyard for the tour. We will support the Tory motion because this motion is not about whether you support the ShipStart Here thing. In fact, supporting it, to support the ShipStart Here would be supporting this motion, in fact, to show that the government says things were done above board. Mr. Wynot just claimed that. Then the opportunity to prove that everything was done above board is to do it in this chamber, in the public view, and to answer those questions. In fact, the only reason you wouldn't support the motion is if you had something to hide. So, Mr. Speaker, we will certainly support this, just as the member well knows and the Premier has acknowledged that all parties supported it. So, Mr. Speaker, the member probably needs to get on side with the Premier, who also recognized that all parties supported the ShipStart Here project.
Mr. D'Entremont.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I thank the member for Dartmouth East for supporting this motion and for saying exactly what I wanted to say, that, of course, all parties supported this as an unanimous motion in the House of Assembly, but we've heard time and time again about the importance of this contract and its importance for Nova Scotia. And I think it's a wonderful thing that Irving Shipyard won it on its own merits. Nova Scotia won it on its own merits, not because there was a flashy campaign of $300,000 that was apparently untendered. If the member says that everything was done above board, then they shouldn't have any problem whatsoever to bring it to the floor of this committee, where we should have a public airing of it. If there's something to hide, well, then obviously they're going to be voting against it. So, apparently you can sort of draw between it that apparently they do have something to hide, and we'll see how this vote goes, and they'll have to answer to Nova Scotians of why this was untendered and why they seem to be to hiding the issues. There must be something further to hide here. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity.
Mr. Wynot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and of course, as you have ruled before, that if anything is going to be tabled, that we have copies for all members. And so right here we have the NSBI procurement policy, and as you'll find on section 3.8 of
Are you going to table that now, please?
Yeah, sure. Just for the opposition there, yeah. In order for in section 3.8 of the alternative procurement, A, unforeseeable situation of urgency or emergency where the goods and service or construction requirement cannot be obtained by means of an open procurement procedures. In this circumstance, the key determinant is that the situation is unforeseeable and truly urgent in nature. So I'd ask for the question, please.
Mr. Younger?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just respond to that. But the policy also requires sign-off, and the documents which were released yesterday indicate the sign-off actually happened after the procurement took place. The issue is the timing of the sign-off, I believe.
Mr. Dunchma?
The other point is I don't understand the emergency that was here. We've known for many years about the shipbuilding contract, about the process that federal government was putting in place for this one. So I don't understand why all of a sudden at an emergency they had to go and procure the services of a marketing company. This is just trying to throw a little bit of fog in on this issue, and which seems to be a usual circumstance by this government. So again, I guess we go to the question on this.
Mr. Wynot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The policy was followed, and I ask for the question, please.
Question. How do you like the question put? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oh, we had four ayes. And opposed?
Nay.
It's a draw.
You break the tie.
I break the tie, and I say aye. Oh, your member voted for it. Member voted for it. So therefore, it'll be put on the agenda. Well, we've got some business to attend to.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Morton. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to clarify my position on this vote. My intent is to vote no, was to vote no. That was my attitude, and maybe I gave a reflex reaction, but I did correct that.
Just 1 second. I asked the solicitor. The member did vote. It was very clear to the chair they did vote. So I would ask the solicitor view on that.
It's up to the chair to rule on the vote. There's, I do add that it's open to any member to appeal to the committee any decision of the chair.
Okay. The member wishes to appeal to the committee, of course, Mr. Morton.
I would certainly like to appeal. Perhaps a way to deal with this would be to call for a recorded vote.
Well, it was already voted on, and it was very clear to the chair that you did vote yes, so therefore the order is going to stand. Okay, the Mr. McKinnon.
Thank you. Appeal was to the committee, not to the chair. And there has been a request for a recorded vote, and that is the appeal. It's the appeal to the committee. It is not an appeal to you, Mr. Chair. You do not represent the full committee.
Solicitor?
Yes, the appeal is to the committee. So it would be a vote by the committee and on the appeal. If you then want to have a recorded vote on the appeal, that's a separate question.
Mr. Younger?
Mr. Chair, I would suggest, however, then the member in question would not be able to vote since he would be in a conflict of interest. And so the appeal would obviously not be successful in any case. Well, you can't vote. You can't go to, you don't get to vote in your own appeal.
Solicitor?
It would be my opinion that all members of the committee would have a vote on the appeal.
Okay. Mr. McKinnon?
Mr. Chair, I would call for a vote, a recorded vote, on the appeal.
On the appeal. It's been cut. Does another member request a recorded vote? Require two members. Mr. Sklar? Okay. It's been called for a recorded vote. All those in favor? Well, signify by saying all those opposed on nay, and we will call the order. Will the clerk ask to call the order of the members to record a vote?
Call them? Okay.
For, on the appeal only.
Okay. Well, I guess starting with you. So, Mr. Caldwell?
In favor, yeah, aye. Of the, no, against the appeal. Okay. Okay, that's fine. In favor of it.
Okay. Mr. Morton?
The appeal.
Mr. McKinnon?
Most certainly, yes.
Mr. Ramey?
Yes.
Mr. Wynot?
Yes.
Mr. Scobar?
Yes.
Mr. Younger?
No.
Mr. Dontremont?
No.
Mr. McMaster?
Nay.
It has been carried. That's in favor of the appeal. Now, we'd entertain a motion to re-vote on the original motion. Mr. McKinnon?
For clarification, the original motion.
Original motion was that we call Mr. Black before the committee to explain the on-tender contract. I'd entertain a motion to revote on that. Mr. Younger, was a motion. My recorded vote again. Was that requested or just by yea and nay? Okay, just so all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
Nay.
Motion is defeated. Okay. Okay, after that long wrangle, we have some minor committee business here. It is my understanding that the NDP caucus may be having a business out of town on March 28th. I believe that's a national convention. Do you want to maintain the March 28th meeting of the Public Accounts Committee? Yes, Mr. Wynot. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 28th is, I don't see any conflict. I don't see any conflict for having the 28th public accounts happen.
Okay, just making sure that we just want to.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
For scheduling purposes.
With
that said, we have the next meeting is next Wednesday, March the 7th, and be followed by a subcommittee meeting immediately after that. So anyone that has new agenda items, would they please bring them forward to the clerk as soon as possible? And an order, motion to adjourn is in order. So moved. We stand adjourned.